Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
An unemployment report that's not quite there yet, and a Greek vote that hasn't quite happened yet. Yeah, I'm sorry. Sometimes the news is just kind of vague. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, committed to empowering professionals of the world with the knowledge needed to do what they do best, the knowledge effect. And by Allianz, insuring more than 80 million customers worldwide and providing retirement solutions through its affiliated companies in the U.S., AllianzUSA.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Happy Friday, gang. It's the 4th of November today. Good, as always, to have you with us. Slow but steady. Decent, but nothing to write home about. That's pretty much been the jobs report mantra for a good long while now, and today's October numbers were more of the same. 80,000 jobs added to the economy, all told, nicely spread out in healthcare and hotels and restaurants and temporary workers, all of which leads to a slight downtick in the unemployment rate to an even 9.0%. There's some relief, in fact, that it wasn't worse, given all that's happening in Athens and Washington and Cannes and who knows where else at the moment. But it's not like this is a job market that's going to get us back to where we need to be now, is it? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman starts us off today.
So what's a really rockin' economy sound like?
This morning, when the Labor Department released the new report on job creation, analysts were expecting the numbers to be good, but they turned out to be twice as good as they'd predicted. Could it be the end of the jobless recovery?
Unfortunately, that's from Marketplace past, October 2004. And the jobless recovery was over. We started getting 250,000, 300,000 new jobs a month for the next couple of years, which isn't remotely likely now, says economist John Canale at LPL Financial.
The jobs that were created during the last part of that recovery won't ever come back.
Canale says housing, which has time and again led the U.S. out of recession, is dead in the water and not reviving.
So there are an awful lot of construction workers, folks in the financial services industry. People with that skill set are no longer needed in the economy.
And economists can't point to any other industry robust enough to absorb 6 million chronically unemployed Americans.
This is really a disastrous situation.
Dean Baker at the Center for Economic and Policy Research argues that we can get back to 300,000 jobs a month and 5% unemployment, but it'll take time.
You have to look for some additional source of stimulus, and obviously if the government were to do another round, doesn't seem likely, but if we were to get some part of President Obama's jobs plan, that would help.
Conservatives counter loosen regulations on private industry and cut government, but that's not likely to jumpstart job creation in the short term either. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Don't look now, but the International Monetary Fund is hip again. 5 or 6 years ago, when the world economy was going gangbusters, kind of seemed like the IMF wasn't needed anymore, but it's back. At the G20 meeting that wrapped up in the south of France today, the IMF said it would be happy to help out in Rome if need be. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that story.
The IMF used to specialize in helping poor countries that were drowning in debt. Now the IMF is supervising Italy, one of the largest economies in the world. Ted Truman is an international economist with the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He says the IMF's new role in Italy is unprecedented.
And it's been a shock to the Europeans. You know, they felt they could wash their own laundry, and that has proved not to be true.
The IMF will be rummaging through Italy's dirty laundry, issuing quarterly reports on whether Rome is falling behind on its promised financial reforms, like raising the retirement age. The IMF will also be setting up some kind of EU emergency fund, but the details still have to be worked out. Some of the money would need to come from newly rich countries like China and Brazil. Will they contribute? Alexei Monserrat is an IMF analyst at the Atlantic Council.
I don't think that anybody going around with a tin cup hoping for people to drop some pennies into it is going to get a whole lot of serious interest unless there's a very clear business case that it makes sense.
There's just not enough confidence that Europe can handle this alone. Mark Weisbrot is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He says China is being extra cautious.
It doesn't make sense for them to be risking very much for Europe. On the other hand, they have $3 trillion of reserves. They could do something.
He says the IMF could give China the reassurance it needs. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Say what you will about the political process in Greece the past couple of days, but they are clearly keenly aware of how their actions are playing in the markets. The no-confidence vote on Prime Minister George Papandreou, originally scheduled for at least close to normal working hours today, has been pushed back to the middle of the night, Athens time, which is to say, after the markets close in New York. Marketplace's Stephen Beard brings us up to speed on what a wild, strange week it's been.
On Monday, the Greek Prime Minister dropped a bombshell. He announced a referendum for the Greek people on their second bailout package. Stock markets across the world fell sharply. Terry Smith, one of London's top financiers, said if the Greeks voted no, there'd be catastrophic consequences.
Greece will default and leave the euro. I think it will probably be followed by similar action in Portugal, Spain, Italy, and even possibly France.
In France, on Tuesday, preparing to host this week's G20 summit, President Nicolas Sarkozy reacted coolly to Papandreou's plan. He said this announcement has taken the whole of Europe by surprise. He summoned Papandreou to come to Cannes to explain himself. Arriving there on Wednesday, Papandreou defended his decision to give his voters a say on the bailout.
It's their democratic right, and the Greek people, I believe, are mature and wise to make the decision that is to the benefit of the Greek people and the country.
But the French and German leaders warned him that Greece wouldn't get any more bailout money unless they voted yes, and if they voted no, they'd have to leave the eurozone. Back in Athens, that threat further dented Papandreou's support. By Thursday, says businessman Konstantin Mihalos, the Greek leader was fighting for his political life.
I think that it is very difficult for him, having seen the reaction by members of his parliamentary group, for him to remain as prime minister.
Papandreou was forced to ditch the referendum plan, and he faces a vote of confidence in his parliament today. He's damaged, but something else was broken in the eurozone this week. For the first time, its leaders admitted that Greece may have to leave. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
George Papandreou, by the way, born in St. Paul, Minnesota. Go figure that one out. On Wall Street today, trading started down, didn't quite make its way back to even. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I know I keep saying this by way of setting up our regular Friday weekly wrap, but man, this has been a pretty interesting 5 days. I'll spare you the list of particulars and get straight to it. The lucky winners this week from our pool of usual suspects are Felix Salmon from Reuters, also Lee Gallagher from Fortune magazine. Hey, you guys.
Hi, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
Is that all right? Usual suspects, you okay with that?
Of course.
All right. We love it.
So we'll go reverse chronologically, I think, Felix, and talk about the jobs report this morning. And here's what I want to know. How does one convince people that 9%, if not the new normal, is closer to where things are going to stay for a while than 4%, which is where it was in the recession on unemployment?
Wait, that's what it is. They don't even need convincing. The question is whether, I mean, politically, the big question is whether the electorate is going to blame Barack Obama for this extremely gruesome state of affairs. But there's no way that he's going to get 4 or 5% unemployment under his presidency, even if he does get reelected.
Yeah, no, I guess that wasn't really the question. The question was, how do you convince people that we're going to be closer to, say, 7 for the you know, next 20 years than we were to 4?
The non-accelerating inflation, the basic rate of unemployment has gone up.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of debate about that. I think it probably has gone up a bit, and that's a strong case for improving the social safety net and you know, looking after this newly permanent class of unemployed people that we have in this country.
Yeah. So, Lee, on that permanently unemployed class of people, talk to me about mood. What is your sense of mood? Even though today's report was moderately upbeat, what do you think?
Well, yeah, the report today wasn't bad. There were revisions upward, which is good. But the Fed a couple of days ago revised growth downward. And that's really where the mood strikes, because that, you know, basically we're kind of settling in and preparing for, as you said, kind of sustained a higher base level. I think the Fed was predicting by 2014 we're going to be looking at somewhere between roughly 7% and 8%. And that's 2014. So I think the mood is going to quickly shift to, OK, let's buckle down for, you know, prepare for a long, cold economic winter for the foreseeable future, which is not a good mood to be in. No.
And remember that the Fed's job is to create full employment. And so the Fed is failing at its job and will be failing at its job for years to come.
And maybe the reason why they're not doing more with policy, not injecting more into the system, is because they can't right now. They just think it's not going to do anything. The problems are more longer term.
Right, they're kind of maxed out. Speaking of longer term problems, let's go to Europe for a second. Forget Papandreou and confidence votes and all this stuff. Felix, who are you more worried about, Greece or Italy?
They're both very worrying.
Come on, Italy.
Okay. Because if Italy goes, then the entire global economy goes into freefall. Italy is Lehman to the power 10. Greece is survivable. The euro might not survive as we know it, but at least the global economy could somehow muddle through. Italy, there's no way we could survive that.
Lee, same question.
Well, this is good because I'll take the other side. I'm much more worried about Greece because Greece is now. Greece is imminent. Greece is what has a chokehold on the global economy right now. And if there's a chance it could get contained, and that, you know, not only Italy but Portugal and all the other countries will not. It won't spill over. But once it does, it's not just going to be Italy that we have to worry about. Yeah. It's going to be everything.
Do you really believe though that it can be contained, Lee?
Look, I think there is something, there's a school of thought that a default can be very, methodically executed. But the more this kind of herky-jerky narrative plays out, the more likely a messy default is going to happen.
This is Greece. This is not the most elegant and professional government in the world. You know, if given the opportunity to do something chaotically, that's normally what happens.
But that's when the ECB can step in and do what it's not doing.
This is good. So I can just step out of this whole interview and you guys can just talk to each other. But sadly, we got to go. Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, Felix Salmon from Reuters. Thanks, you guys. Have yourselves a good weekend.
Thanks, Guy.
Cheers.
Bye. Shares of Bank of America tumbled today. Shareholders weren't happy about its plan to issue new stock to bump up capital reserves. And a lot of account holders aren't happy with B of A either, which is in part why tomorrow has been proclaimed Bank Transfer Day. It was so designated by a Bank of America customer here in Los Angeles, angry about the bank's infamous and, now it should be said, rescinded $5 a month debit card fee. The idea behind Bank Transfer Day is for people to abandon big banks for smaller, more local institutions. And partly as a result, credit unions, those sleepy not-for-profit cooperatives, are flush with $4.5 billion in new deposits. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith has more now on the money migration.
The debit card fee Bank of America and other big banks rolled out ignited an uproar.
The $5 debit card use fee was sort of my last straw.
33-year-old Melissa Wilson is a Bank of America customer. Well, she was. The debit card fee made her so angry, she left B of A. And even when the bank nixed the fee, she didn't look back.
It's just too little too late. The fact that they even tried to do it was enough for me.
Between debit fees and Occupy Wall Street, community banks and credit unions smell opportunity.
We'll let the big banks take care of Wall Street. We'll be right here, taking care of Main Street. Own your money. Join a credit union.
Credit unions are extending hours and creating switch kits, step-by-step guides to leaving your bank. Bill Cheney is president of the Credit Union National Association.
We've heard from credit unions from all across the country that they've seen an increase in business. We've heard anywhere from double their normal new account volume to five times as much.
Cheney's organization reports that since Bank of America unveiled its debit card fee, 650,000 people have joined credit unions. That's more new accounts in 6 weeks than credit unions registered all of last year.
Among my group of friends, people are leaving in droves and joining credit unions.
That's 29-year-old Taylor Overstreet from Austin, Texas. This week, she moved her money from Chase Bank to a local credit union. She wasn't unhappy with Chase, but she wanted to join the movement against big banks.
Friends on Facebook and Twitter talking about switching over. I had visited the Occupy Austin website, and I think it was Bank Action Day. So I guess you could say it was effective marketing.
The recent defections to credit unions aren't enough to impact the big guys right now, says analyst Ron Shevlin with the iTake Group. Those banks have millions of accounts, and many of the people leaving are young and not the most lucrative customers. Still, Shevlin says the big banks should be worried.
The impact of Bank Transfer Day shouldn't be thought of in a single day perspective. The bigger impact is 10 to 15 years out.
When those former customers are in their earning prime and banking elsewhere. Not that switching is trouble-free. When she moved her money out of Bank of America, Melissa Wilson forgot to cancel the automatic transfer she'd set up between her checking and savings accounts.
It charged me an overdraft fee for trying to transfer money that wasn't there from one account to another.
Wilson has paid more than $500 in fees to Bank of America this year and says she didn't have the energy to fight the last one. So she surrendered another $10. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Coming up, how not to handle the business of social media.
You don't walk in with your megaphone blasting your marketing message and, you know, buy my stuff.
But first, let's do the numbers. Well, the Dow Industrials fell 61 points this Friday, about a half percent, ended at 11,983. The NASDAQ erased 11 points, 0.4%, 2686 at the bell. The S&P 500 cleared away 7 points, 0.6%, 1253 is the number you're looking for. So ends a lousy week, though. Since Monday, the Dow impact 2%, the NASDAQ close behind with a loss of 1.9%. The S&P 500 peeled away 2.5%. Bank of America unbanked 6%. Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Morgan Stanley each fell more than 1%. Goldman Sachs down nearly 2.5% at the close today. Groupon rocketed up 30% in its trading debut. Today, at least, investors apparently thought its business model is worth something. So maybe now we can stop talking about the Groupon IPO. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, in support of Small Business Saturday and small businesses every day of the week. Learn more at ConstantContact.com/Saturday. By Chevrolet, maker of the new Volt, which plugs in anywhere and goes everywhere. Available in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In New York, the Federal Reserve will release the consumer report for September. In Washington, the Census Bureau will release new research on how to measure poverty in America. And Monday marks the first day of National Animal Shelter Appreciation Week. It was started in 1996 by the Humane Society of the United States. I'm Desiree Pena.
This is Marketplace from APM. That's American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The White House came right out yesterday and said something it's really only hinted at before. A guy named Robert Bryant, he's the head of U.S. counterintelligence, said the Russians and the Chinese are using cyber attacks to steal American technology and then use it for their own economic gain. And cybercrime is an equal opportunity offender, as you know. Earlier this year, a European criminal group was arrested for draining about $72 billion from personal bank accounts using an especially malicious bit of software called the Conficker Worm. Mark Bowden writes about that worm in his new book, Worm, The First Digital World War, it's called. Mark, good to have you with us.
Thank you, Kai.
Tell me what this worm does, the Conficker Worm.
What it does mostly is infect computers, connect them to one another, and set them up so that they can receive orders from a remote controller.
Sounds very Armageddon-like, I got to tell you.
Well, it can be. I mean, if you can link together a million, or in this case, 10 to 12 million computers, you have a remarkably powerful, essentially supercomputer at your bidding. And you could use it for all manner of things, including launching an attack that could literally crash the internet itself.
You know, as I hear you say Conficker, and I've been mispronouncing it the whole time, who names these things?
Well, this one was named by a group of engineers at Microsoft. And one of the first things that this very cunning little piece of software did when it invaded a computer was attempt to contact a well-known spam distributor online called trafficconverter.biz. So they were fooling around with the syllables of trafficconverter.biz, and they came up with Conficker, which was, well, Ficker is German for the sexual act, and their nice. Feelings about the worm were that it was a real mother ficker.
Right, right. So this book will sell because it has your name on it and it's getting lots of press and all that. But it seems to me that there's a disconnect between the message you deliver in this book, which is that these things can be really, really destructive and we have to pay attention, and the fact that most people just want their computers to work, man. We don't care what goes on in the guts.
Well, I think that's fair. I would hope that anyone who reads the book would better understand why botnets like the Conficker botnet pose a very serious threat, not so much to the individual computer user, although it does that too, but primarily to society at large. Nowadays, if you have the knowledge and a computer and you're connected and, or control something like the Conficker botnet, you could wreak terrific havoc on modern society all by your lonesome.
Well, you know, along those lines, and to pull off the subtitle of the book, which is The First Digital World War, I mean, you know, the White House has started to pay attention to this stuff, and people are, I think, growing in awareness. What are we doing, though, that can legitimately fight them? How do we defend ourselves?
Well, I think ultimately, Kai, the answer is going to be to create some sort of parallel internet that can provide for a higher level of security. The internet that we have, which is a wonderful tool, was created basically to make it easier to share information, to exchange data. And, you know, that's a great function. But it turns out there's a lot of data that we as individuals or that banks or credit card companies or the United States government has a very legitimate need to keep private. And the internet is not really very good at that.
Not to get all Machiavellian here, but one has to assume, perhaps even hope, that the Department of Defense and the White House and the administration have their own botnet army ready to go, right?
Well, I would assume that's the case. You know, the most famous instance of a targeted piece of malware in the last few years was Stuxnet, which,
right,
of course,
right,
took out the uranium enrichment activities in Iran. You know, I think cyber warfare is very much a part of the modern world now. And particularly in the last few years, I do think the federal government has gotten a lot more attuned to the need to both defend our networks in this country, although I don't think they're capable of doing it just yet, but also to develop the ability to use these things as weapons ourselves.
Mark Bowden's latest book is called Worm, The First Digital World War. Mark, thanks a lot.
My pleasure, Kai. Thank you.
This is the story.
Social networking. That's all you ever hear anymore. And in our context, what it can do for business and you. And yeah, I tweet and sometimes I blog and maybe a couple more people listen to the program because of it. But there are days when I wonder what the point is. Handily, then, there's a conference in Los Angeles this week called Blog World. We sent Marketplace's Adrian Hill to explore what the costs and actual benefits of social media really are.
This is the story of two very different companies trying to figure out their social media strategies. One is launching a new vodka called Euphoric, spelled with the letter U and the number 4 and a K.
It's a premium vodka. It's grape-based. So it comes from wine grapes. It's not like your traditional vodkas that come from starch.
That's the company's marketing consultant, John Burke. The other company sells something perhaps less sexy and more necessary than high-end vodka, contact lenses.
In the United States, there's four major players that dominate 98% of the market. We are a part of the 2% other.
That's Courtney McMillan, a VP at the contact company, Polyview.
We have a neglected Facebook page, and that's basically about it.
McMillan is here to figure out what kind of social media strategy her office of four people can pull off. Burke, from the vodka company, is looking to develop a social media strategy that'll have people ordering Euphoric right along with Grey Goose and Belvedere. They're both looking for easy and fast ways to reach those bazillions of people on blogs and Facebook and Twitter. So it's off to conference land, a world of projected presentations, scripted jokes, stale coffee, and sometimes real nuggets of information. Jason Falls is the CEO of Social Media Explorer. He says you've got to think of social media like a cocktail party.
You don't walk in with your megaphone blasting your marketing message and, you know, buy my stuff.
Because then no one would like you. They will unfriend you. They will unfollow you. Instead,
You listen to the conversations and find the ones that make sense to you, and you start to introduce yourself and network and grow relationships over time.
Friends don't come easy. If you're a company, the value of social media is about getting people to trust you or think you're cool. And when those people need something, to think of buying it from you because they trust you or think you're cool. That, it turns out, can take a lot of time. And even though a lot of the tools of social media, like Facebook and Twitter and Blogger, are free,
social media is by no means free. It is not inexpensive.
Jay Baer runs a social media consultancy firm.
It's just different expensive. You are trading advertising dollars or production dollars for labor dollars. It is extraordinarily time intensive to do this well.
Ooh, so not cheap, not easy, not fast. At the end of the day, I check in to see how McMillan and Burke are faring.
It is pretty overwhelming.
But also intriguing. McMillan thinks her office might be able to create a blog that brings new eyeballs to her company website. Burke also has a head full of ideas. But here's the thing.
At the core of it, it's not really different from just traditional marketing. It's really making sure that you listen to your customer, that you know your customer, that you do your research, that you make your messaging be real and authentic, and you try to make that connection.
And really, just be that super likable guy or gal at the cocktail party. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation.com, protecting online privacy by removing your personal data from the internet and stopping unwanted email. Reputation.com. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, the hearing of which will do nothing to ease the average person's discomfort with how Wall Street operates. Remember the other day we told you how federal regulators think MF Global, the now defunct brokerage house, had commingled customers' money with company money, mostly because investigators couldn't find hundreds of millions of dollars in customers' money? Well, now MF Global said it thinks it knows where the money is. It's in an account at J.P. Morgan, all $659 million of it. J.P. Morgan says, nuh-uh. We don't have it. We don't know where it is. You chuckle, only so you don't cry. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media this Friday. Today, the Dow fell 61 points, about 0.5%. The NASDAQ erased 11 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 cleared away 7 points, 0.6 of 1%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace's acting producer is Megan Larson. The executive producer is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager of the Marketplace Enterprise. Coming up this weekend on our personal financial Marketplace Money, if you're out there looking for a job, just one word for you, perseverance.
If someone has enough initiative to drive and hand deliver a resume to every single veterinarian in the Willamette Valley, this person must really want a job.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend. We'll meet you back here on Monday. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.